right, we are back. We've been having too much fun in this show. Next 20 minutes, I think we're going to round out with some more serious topics, not necessarily grim, but maybe a little more serious. First of all, I should mention that I promised you that if we could, for the upcoming commemoration for the 30-year anniversary of Roe versus Wade, which will take place before our next reconvening, next week's show, we wanted to have someone come on and talk about the partial birth abortion. I know someone that had to get this procedure. It's a dramatic and in some ways terrible story, but it was very good for this person and his wife that this procedure was still legal and available. There are many that would take that away from us. And we will, in February, have an interview with him, and it'll be, believe me, it will be probably one of the most compelling things we've ever put out over the airways on the show, and I'm looking forward to having him tell that story. Okay. Sacramento Bee, front page story, timetable slips for an Iraq war. Interestingly, people were talking some months back about going to war here in January. In fact, I have some articles, some clippings I've been putting into a mound to talk about regarding this, many dating to August that were referring to the upcoming preparations for war. But it looks as though war, if it's going to come, will be in early March at the soonest. The weapons inspectors, of course, are talking about needing a year to look around. The hawks in the Bush administration, such as Richard Perle, that have been pushing war. And as Bob Woodward said on Terry Gross some weeks ago, they were planning a war with Iraq long before September 11th. Well, they may be losing some ground right now. Maybe there won't be a war at all. That would be a good thing, I think, in this case. I was suckered in the first time. I bought into it in 91, and I guess sometimes you get smarter when you get older, and this war doesn't really make a great deal of sense. On a rather whimsical note, I would refer you to Slate Magazine, which is on MSN, an excellent, excellent series of articles appears in Slate every day. They've been running one now since November called The Saddam Meter. With chance of invasion, the odds of war changed every few days. Currently, the Saddam meter stands at 61% probability of going to war. And they actually have charted out where they figure these odds have been. They've been as high as 70% or earlier this month. They were as low as 50% in early December. We'll see where it goes. I hope that war can be avoided, but I'm optimistic a little bit more than the usual at this point. So I think we'll lay off our usual reference to the theme song, where we usually play the Fredonia's Going to War from Duck Soup. We'll skip that. But I can't resist mentioning on our Osama count that it is now day 492 in the still unsuccessful search for Osama bin Laden. I would remind you that the crisis of Jimmy Carter's administration, that of the Iranian hostage situation, lasted 444 days. We are now pushing 50 days past that entire event that supposedly held the nation hostage. But we are still being held hostage by Al-Qaeda. I mean, look what's happening to air travel still as we try and get around. I hope that he can be found, and I wish we would spend a lot of time looking instead of making up a war with Iraq. All right, I saved a clipping from November titled, "We Didn't Mess Up, Pollsters Insist," from the Cox News Service. This was printed in the Bee. Political pollsters were not saying oops after November's election. While admitting that they didn't predict Tuesday's Republican electoral sweep, pollsters said they forecast a series of tight elections across the country, and that's what happened. Well, fast forward 2 months, January 13, six major news organizations announced Monday they were disbanding Voter News Service, the consortium they'd built to count votes and conduct surveys on Election Day. The decision follows two major election night failures in a row by VNS. Now, given the expense of mounting such an operation on their own, I don't know why it should be that much, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News Channel, and AP said they were considering other options. Now, we all know what happened in the 2000 election when basically all our eggs were in one basket, relying on the numbers from one service to incorrectly tell us that George Bush had won in Florida. After messing up, supposedly, the fact that Al Gore looked like he was going to win in Florida. We'll see what's going to happen. They're going to go independent now, as they used to do. I mean, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the news agencies had their own independent people they consulted, which meant there was a lot of redundancy, and which meant that you weren't just relying on one person's opinion. I think this is a move in the right direction. We'll see what happens. Now, the Sacramento News and Review, January 2nd issue, had a wonderful little guest commentary by Sue Wilson, award-winning Sacramento television and radio producer I wanted to quote from on the program. Sue Wilson pointed out that this month, the Federal Communications Commission, under the chairmanship of Michael Powell, will consider whether to change the rules concerning media ownership. Under the proposed new rules, one company in a community would be able to own the newspaper, several TV and radio stations, the cable system, and the principal internet access company. Again, if it's a good idea to have more than one source for your vote counting, it's a good idea to have more than one source for your news. The concentration of media ownership in this country is a scary deal, folks. And we are going to talk about this at length in an upcoming program. We're probably going to devote an entire show to this. Because basically, you know, 9 or 10 companies are controlling most of the news that's being moved around. Now, Stuart Gardner is going to come on and talk about the fact that Rupert Murdoch, the owner of the News Corporation, decided to make a millionaire out of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Stuart will talk with us at length about that subject in the next week or two. I think we should be worried when News Corporation, owned by Murdoch, through a subsidiary, a book corporation, HarperCollins, basically makes a millionaire out of a Supreme Court justice that's supposed to then rule on issues of media control and ownership. I think it smells kind of bad, and we're going to follow that story. But back to the guest commentary, I was unaware of the fact that there was an upstart station, KSTE, which in the mid-90s, with a liberal talk format. Imagine that, talking and being liberal. KSTE gained swift ratings ground on KFBK 1530, the radio home of Rush Limbaugh. And at this point, Chancellor Broadcasting, who owns KFBK, subsequently purchased their potential rival KSTE and simultaneously took away both the station's liberal voice and its rating. So now there is no wide diversity of the news, which is one reason, you know, I think you should listen to this show and other public affairs shows here on KDVS. You're going to get some perspectives that that certainly not going to be heard on KFBK. In this well-written commentary, Sue Wilson points out that, I love this, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Medved, Michael Savage, Tom Sullivan, and others all have conservative points of view. There are no liberals. The owner of one station told her, well, we do have Rush on the right, yes, but we have Dr. Laura on the left. Enough said. And since we mentioned Dr. Laura, I just can't help reminding you that in December, Dr. Laura's mother was found slain in a Beverly Hills condo. It's a great tragedy. Dr. Laura spoke about it and blamed their estrangement on her mother. Said that they'd been estranged since 1986 when her mother walked off her job as Laura's secretary. I had a volume on Dr. Laura written by Vicki Bain that opens up talking to Dr. Laura's mom, who basically swore the author to secrecy and said she wouldn't tell various stories. She did note in the book that if it's true that Laura had tried to contact her mother, which she told Larry King on a show in 1998, that they're not attempts that Laura talked about in her book, The Ten Commandments, whose longest chapter, I'd like to point out, is devoted to the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother so that your days will be lengthened upon the land that the Lord your God gives you. Well, I don't know. It just seems to me that honoring your mother would mean that she wouldn't lie dead in a condo without anybody finding her for months at a time. I don't know. That's just me. 2 weeks back, the Associated Press carried a story from Washington noting that environmentalists were suing the federal government for easing its dolphin-safe tuna labeling. The Commerce Department said the tuna that fishermen catch by encircling dolphins may immediately now be imported in the United States and still retain the dolphin-safe label if observers, apparently in Mexican waters, certify that no dolphins were killed or seriously injured in the process. The Earth Island Institute and other groups were filing a lawsuit in federal court hours after the Commerce Department revised its labeling standard. Under the old definition, any tuna caught using dolphins as targets were automatically barred from bearing the consumer-friendly label on cans sold in the United States. Now, Mexico is a major source of tuna, but it's been prevented from full access to the huge United States market because Mexico targets dolphins, puts out large nets. The dolphins get caught up in the nets, as we know, and they drown because they're mammals, not fish. Well, an attorney for the Humane Society in the U.S. said it was unconscionable that for the first time in over a decade, dolphin deadly tuna will be sold in the United States, misleading consumers about the dolphin's safe designation. Now, I went into my pantry and looked at my cans of tuna, and indeed, they'd say dolphin safe on the side. Environmentalists noted that some major tuna processors, including Starkist, Bumblebee, and Chicken of the Sea, have pledged that they would not buy tuna caught by targeting and netting dolphins. Still, the government's new stamp of approval on some tuna could change that. In a story that's not related but has Mexico in common, there was an article in the New York Times, Mexico City, more than $100 million is sitting frozen in a Swiss bank account once controlled by Raul Salinas, the brother of a former president of Mexico. The former president, Carlos Salinas, president from 88 to 94, now lives in self-imposed exile in Ireland, whereas Raul has been in a maximum security prison since 1995, where he is serving a 27-year sentence for ordering the murder of his brother-in-law. They're not sure where this money came from, $100 million. They are pretty sure that it's a shady deal, perhaps from cocaine deals in which Raul Salinas was protecting, bringing cocaine into the United States. I don't know. It's kind of curious. $100 million turns up. Geez, whose is this? But Swiss banking law is famous for its secrecy, which is why, you know, corrupt strongmen from all over the world trust the Swiss when it comes to, you know, stashing away large caches of illegal loot. Now, I just sort of mentioned this in conjunction with the Mexican tuna story because Mexico is notoriously corrupt politically. It's very easy to purchase observers who will certify that no dolphins were killed or injured in the process of catching the tuna. The Commerce Department needs to rethink this one. Another article from Slate magazine worth mentioning, titled, What Would Ariana Drive? The Preachy New Crusade Against SUVs. Now, last year, a Christian group called the Evangelical Environmental Network came out with an anti-gas-guzzling spot that asked, what would Jesus drive? Now, a group of Hollywood crusaders led by pundit Arianna Huffington and friends, calling themselves the Detroit Project, have put together an ad that parodies an earlier government campaign linking drugs and terror. Their spots say that it's SUVs that fund Al-Qaeda. Kind of a provocative gambit, but is it successful? I don't know. Apparently in these ads, they showed people like in the role of SUV owners saying things like, I helped hijack an airplane, and I helped blow up a nightclub, and even I sent our soldiers off to war. Comments interspersed with defensive ones like, it makes me feel safe. Everybody has one. And finally, my life, my SUV. Well, I think that, I don't know, we've gone through this whole thing about big car versus small car back in the 70s when there was the first Arab oil embargo. I know that Detroit and everybody else, apparently, there's something like 74 types of SUVs on the market right now. That's where they're making all of their money. But these gas hogs just, you know, most people don't need to drive an SUV. And these guys tooling down I-5, cutting me off. You guys annoy me. I wish that, I wish that people would not have this attitude that, you know, bigger is better and, you know, that, you know, daring you to go head to head with them. Now, interestingly, people who feel that they are much safer in an SUV may be wrong. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety did an analysis of annual deaths on the highway and discovered that small cars are statistically safer than drivers of the average sport utility vehicle. The argument that lowering the weight of cars to achieve high fuel economy has resulted in excess deaths is unfounded. Now, I thought this was settled a long time ago. I mean, littler cars being more nimble, you know, may allow you to get out of an accident situation faster. SUVs are notoriously unable to pass tests that require them to swerve to avoid an object and then swerve back. They're not sports cars. And admittedly, if I'm driving a small car, I don't want to get hit by one. but, you know, it may be harder to avoid an accident in one. So, I don't know, regardless of what Arianna Huffington's got to say about tying SUV use to people that would attack the United States, which may be a bit questionable, the stats show that even the safest SUV on the road, the mammoth Chevrolet Suburban, is bested by the much smaller Honda Accord and Toyota Camry. I think it is undeniable that oil and politics and the attacks on the U.S., and our gasoline guzzling, they do all link up to one another. Sierra Magazine published in the same issue a picture of a poster during World War II. When you ride alone, you ride with Hitler. Join a car-sharing club today. This poster shows a guy with his driving along with this ghostly figure of the Führer sitting in the right seat. Now, in World War II, people did sacrifice. They were given basically 3 gallons of gasoline per week. Oh, how things have changed. When White House spokesman Ari Fleischer was asked some months back whether the ongoing issue of oil and war in the Middle East meant that perhaps we should economize on gasoline, maybe drive fewer SUVs, his response was that we consider driving fuel-inefficient cars to be one of the blessings of American life. And that, no, the administration was certainly not going to push any conservation. Well, we're running out of time. We should mention a few milestones before we go. Maurice Gibb of the Bee Gees passed away during surgery. I think that's sad. I kind of like the Bee Gees. I think that their Saturday Night Fever soundtrack remains a classic, despite it being one of the paragons of the much maligned disco movement. I still think they did some really good music. Another guy that you probably didn't hear mentioned much in the press, who also passed away recently, was the actor who used to play Sergeant Preston of the Yukon on television, a show that was based on the long-running successful radio program, a show that I used to watch when I was a very little kid. And I'm sorry for the passing of Sergeant Preston. We're just about out of time. I want to thank our guests, Sean Minton and Sir Paul McCartney, for appearing earlier on the program. On next week's show, we expect to have the long-awaited Bad Music program. We're going to devote one segment, probably perhaps for the next 2 weeks or maybe even 3 weeks. One of our segments will be devoted to music, because music is important to all of us. And we're specifically going to focus in on bad music. Stay tuned for some music programming that's not bad to follow with Todd Urich, whose show Hometown Atrocities is taking the place of our friend Gina. So I'm sure Todd will have some very interesting and eclectic selections for your listening pleasure. Stick around. You've been listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I am your host. I've been joined here by my sound engineer, Mr. Edward McMillan. We'll see you again next Thursday. But as we go, again, keep in mind you're going to be hearing some really interesting and bad stuff in the weeks to come, and there's not much worse than what I think we'll go out with now. We'll see you.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. The girl with a sun in her eyes, and she's gone. She's gone. She's gone. Bridge by a fountain where rocking horse people eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore waiting to take you away. Climb in the back with your head in the clouds and you're gone! picture yourself on a train in a station with plasticine porters, with looking glass ties. Suddenly, someone is there at the turnstile. A girl with kaleidoscope